Hello and welcome to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, coming to you from the Tour of Britain. Those were the sounds of the Tour of Britain playing us in there. My name is Richard Moore and I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Don't wave, Lionel. You did that last week. It doesn't work.
It's becoming a habit, the waving. Sorry for listeners.
That was very odd indeed, actually. Lionel, where are we?
We are in the bar.
Drying off
at the Tumbling Weir Hotel in Ottery St Mary in Devon, the home of poet.
I don't think it's the home, I think it's the birthplace. I think he still lives here.
No longer the home of Samuel Taylor Coleridge.
We've got lots to talk about the Tour of Britain. This is a Tour of Britain special. We've got interviews with Dan Lloyd and Roger Hammond. We've got an interview with the Garmin Sharp bus driver. And we're going to discuss the race as it stands, with a few days still to go and Bradley Wiggins in the gold jersey.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Right, Lionel, this is reminiscent of the trip again. We stayed in a lovely B&B last night in the middle of Wales, or North Wales.
Beautiful.
Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
What was it called again?
Oh, that's putting
it. It was a Welsh name. We're going to look that up and then tell you, because we really feel we should recommend it.
Yeah.
Very cheap, fantastic three-course meal.
Just really nicely looked after. Mm-hmm. The building itself was lovely. The owner was lovely. The meal was fantastic.
Amazing meal.
It's amazing what you can find when you're
looking at TripAdvisor. So, the race. We arrived yesterday for the stage that started in Stoke-on-Trent and finished in Lamberis. The place where Dave Brailsford grew up.
Yeah.
Where he moved and went to secondary school, certainly, just at the foot of Snowdon. Yesterday we saw Bradley Wiggins' first day in gold and defended it pretty well. I spoke last week about what strong Team Sky have at this Tour of Britain, and you know, they've ridden from the start of the race as though they had the lead. They've taken control of it right from the start. Mm. And a very sure-footed performance so far from Bradley Wiggins, who we last heard of really at the Giro d'Italia, where he suffered in the miserable weather. Now, the descents here are not perhaps on the same scale as the descents at the Giro, but he's looked very comfortable. He seems very relaxed and very confident.
Yeah, it looks like he's got his mojo back, doesn't it? I mean, Dave Brailsford, before the Tour of Britain, was talking about how seriously they were taking it, and Wiggins has kind of not let slip, but he has certainly revealed just how much preparation he put into this race. Went and rode the time trial course at Knowsley Park repeatedly. He said that he'd practiced the corners at different speeds until he got so fast that he knew exactly how, you know, the top speed that he could take some of those corners. So he clearly highlighted that as a place to take time. But then to hear that he'd also been down to Caerphilly to ride Caerphilly Mountain and the sort of finishing loop. And
that is extraordinary, really, isn't it?
It is extraordinary. I mean, it's easy to joke that, well, he had nothing else to do in July because he wasn't at the Tour de France, but
that was last week he was wrecking around here, though.
Well, yeah, but he's done a lot of training at home. He says, and obviously the World Championships time trial is the big focus of the end of the year. But the Tour of Britain, as Dave Brailsford described it when I spoke to him before the race started, it is more important than its actual standing in the UCI calendar.
To them as a team.
They're the home team. And they've never really impressed too.
Well, they've done the opposite of impressing.
Yeah, I mean, Ian Stannard was second for them, and I think Greg Henderson was third for them in the first Tour of Britain, which they fouled up, really.
2010, yeah.
In Sky's first Tour of Britain, 2010. So, you know, the pressure is on them to win their home tour, and this year they've hit it hard. And so far, I mean, what was impressive on the stage at Llanberis was that Sky's plan was executed absolutely perfectly. I mean, that group of 11 that was away was dangerous looking because it was a smaller group first, and then some more riders went across, and with the size of the field and the fact that Sky have only got six riders to try and control, one of which obviously Bradley Wiggins in the lead and second placed Ian Stannard, it's a lot of riding for four riders to do to keep that gap. But they did it really smartly. They used up their men kind of in order. Matt Heyman and Bernie Eisel came in last and second last, sort of 7-8 minutes down. They absolutely buried themselves to bring the gap back to a manageable amount. And then Ian Stannard, who they'd protected all day, kind of turned on the turbo over the top of the last climb.
Yeah, pretty
on the
descent. Smart use of limited resources with it being a six-man team. And, you know, you look at the team here, and it's not clearly the Tour de France, but this is the Sky A team, you know, Eisel and Heyman as well. I don't really understand why Heyman's never had a shot at the Tour, because I think he's been an outstanding domestique for Sky. And Bernie Eisel, to me, it's baffling that he wasn't at the Tour this year. The other guy is Josh Edmondson, the young Brit who performed so well last year. And interestingly, Wiggins in his press conference yesterday, quite amusingly, said that he didn't want to put any pressure on the guy when he was asked about Josh Edmondson, and then in the next breath said, but I think you're looking at a guy who could win the Tour de France there in the future.
Yeah.
That was slightly, that was an odd thing to say, really, considering he just said, don't want to put any pressure on the guy. But he does look a class act, doesn't he?
Edmondson certainly does, yeah. I think he's fitted right in this week with the teamwork role that he's had to take on, and he's done it well. And I think Sky, you know, we shouldn't overdo how well they controlled the race, because nobody, it's not really in anybody else's interest to try and take that work off them. Mm. But they've controlled some tricky looking moves. I mean, Martin and Quintana are almost sort of riding around the Tour of Britain hand in hand.
It's a hard race to control with the lack of radios and lack of information generally. Yeah, I mean, one of the great things, it's great to see class riders who we've seen at the Tour recently, like Quintana and Martin, perform here, because often in the past we've seen the big stars come and we've not really been aware of them in the race. It's fantastic to see a guy like Quintana take off up the climbs like we know he can, and it's wonderful to see these class riders perform like that outside of the Tour de France, and I think that's been a bit of a change in the sport. And you mentioned Wiggins has got his mojo back, and you know that's a good point. We are seeing, you know, it's almost easy to forget just how dominant he was in stage races like this last year. And it's like the Wiggins of last year, and he does seem to be happy, and I think this has been a good target for him, because it does salvage a disappointing season, and he's got to be a contender for the time trial next week as well. But Tour of Britain, in terms of profile in his home country, it reminds people he's still around. It'd be funny if it ends up getting him a nomination for BBC Sports Personality.
Well, the thing is, you know, Dave Brouse was saying that if Wiggins was able to win the time trial, maybe get the gold jersey, perhaps even win the race, it would put a smile back on everybody's face as far as Bradley Wiggins is concerned, because we've seen the reaction from the crowds at the starts. He is a huge hero here. You know, people, the crowds around the Sky bus are big, he gets a great reception, you know, he doesn't have to do much to have the crowd on his side. And I think, you know, for Bradley Wiggins, looking for the next sort of couple of seasons, depending on what he's going to target in those couple of seasons, I think to salvage something from a year in which almost nothing has gone right up to this point, pretty important.
And pretty impressive, that because he is somebody who state of mind is so important, motivation is so important, and you know he can be an all or nothing type character. And I wondered if these two goals of Tour of Britain and time trial were almost not false goals, but slightly manufactured goals that were being dreamt up in order to give him something to focus on, and perhaps the desire wouldn't be there to actually meet them. But I think it is there, and this has been a hard week, you know, for everybody. The weather has been the talking point, and it has been tough. And you know, we saw in the Giro how he came unstuck, and he did say today that the one thing he feared was the cold. That's what he really fears. Today was a bit warmer, but it has been miserable. And the one disappointment, I suppose, has been for the fans, who have nevertheless been coming out in large numbers, but seeing riders wrapped up in layers of, you know, rain capes, and you don't see the gold jersey because he's covered in a rain cape. We were in a cafe in the Stark Village this morning where I recorded those rain sound effects, actually, and there were some Node 4 riders came and sheltered beneath the canopy, and they looked traumatized already, and the stage hadn't started yet. There was no kind of humour. There were just fixed sort of expressions on their faces. Just kind of, they were just fearful of what
was going on. That's because it's been the fifth day where the rain played a big part. I mean, the first half of today's stage, to Caer Philly, was played out in driving rain, really. The rain was blowing sort of almost horizontal. Fortunately, the sun came out for quite a bit of the second half of the stage.
Yeah, we had a bit of a disaster there, didn't we, Lionel?
In terms of driving
from the start to the finish. It wasn't as straightforward as it should have been, really.
No, we kept getting stuck behind the convoy of the race, sort of Truman Show style. Every time we thought we got in front of them, there it was, of the traffic jam.
Helicopter overhead.
Yeah, behind the bunch. And so it was just one of those days where it didn't work out. But it was tough for us today because, obviously, the route and the diversion that journalists and off-race traffic has to take were basically crisscrossed each other all day. So but it worked out perfectly because we arrived at Caer Philly Castle with about 20 minutes of the race to go. We saw them come past. We saw them finish. And
landed on our feet.
Yeah, landed on our feet.
And here we are in this beautiful hotel in this little village in Devon. And we sit down, we've got a pint, and we've got a copy of Hello magazine with Victoria Pendleton's wedding featuring prominently inside. So that's the evening taken care of.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore and Lionel Burney.
We were going to talk briefly about the British teams, and we've got these interviews with Dan Lloyd, who's making his directorial debut here, and Roger Hammond, who's in the second year of his career as a direct sportif. It's a big old task for the British teams to do anything here. I mean, fantastic win today for Sam Bennett, for the Irishman, one of the, I suppose, second string teams. For any of those teams to get anything out of the Tour of Britain is a fantastic achievement, isn't it? You know a bit about Sam Bennett, do you not?
Well, yeah, I spoke to Sean Kelly this evening. Sam Bennett is one of the Irish riders on the An Post Chain Reaction Cycles team, which of course is the Sean Kelly team, really. It was set up partly as the Irish Cycling Federation wanted a development squad. Sean Kelly got involved. They're based in Belgium. They're directed by a man called Kurt Bogertz. And the story of Kurt Bogertz is quite interesting because when he was a teenager aspiring to be a professional rider, he lived in the same town in Belgium that Sean Kelly lived in, and I think he was maybe 14, 15 years old, perhaps a little bit older, but one day he just went and knocked on Sean Kelly's door and said, "I want to be a pro one day, can I come training with you?" And Sean Kelly, not really the kind of guy that would want that sort of company, perhaps, on a training ride. There was something, more or less, yeah. As long as you sit on my wheel and you don't talk too much, you can come out. And so Kurt Bogertz started going out training with Sean Kelly. Clearly didn't annoy Kelly too much. And here we are years later, and Bogertz has run that team. And he really does run it like a
family. And he was in tears at the finish.
He was in tears, yeah. And he said, you know, we've taken some beating.
He was unlucky into Kendall on Monday,
right.
Sam Bennett.
Yes,
he almost won that stage, and Sulek came past him at the
And Kelly has said, you know, that one of the things they've worked with Sam Bennett is to try and persuade him that he isn't just a sprinter, and that when the moves go over tough little climbs like Caer Philly today,
because it was a small group,
he's got the punch to get in that move, and then the finish to take the victory. And the way he rode around the last bend and took the race on and was the fastest finisher out of a pretty impressive group bodes well for, you know, for his future. And I think, you know, one of the things that the An Post team, sponsored by the Irish Postal Service, but always sort of on the lookout for sponsorship to try and keep things going, because it's very difficult for a squad of that size. And it's a bit like the British squads of an equivalent size if they uncover a good rider, they will move on, of course, and there's no compensation for them. For example, Gaminas Bagdonas, the Lithuanian, who won a stage of the Tour of Britain for Ann Post in Sandringham, I think it was, a couple of years ago, moved on to Quickstep eventually. So they're developing riders and moving them on to the next level, but that doesn't necessarily benefit a team like Ann Post. And no. in the British case,
Brailsford's spoken about this in the past, the absence of any transfer market in cycling, and how unfair that is on teams that do develop talent.
Yeah, but the sort of double edge of that is that in order to be able to sell a rider to a bigger team, you would have to put these young riders on longer term contracts. And for a team like Ann Post, you know, and I guess, you know, the British equivalents, so, you know, Rafa Condor and Rally and Madison Genesis, IG Sigma, the difficulty would be how can they guarantee somebody a 2, 3, or 4 year contract in order to then profit somehow when that rider is approached by
Rafa Condor, JLT, I think we should have said there, Lionel.
Not sorry about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the British teams, we spoke, you spoke yesterday to Dan Lloyd, I spoke today to Roger Hammond. They're both involved in these in IG Sigma in Dan Lloyd's case, and Madison Genesis in the case of Roger Hammond. And we'll hear, I think, first from Dan Lloyd and then from Roger Hammond. Here they are.
I'm with Dan Lloyd, who is team director for the IG Sigma Sport team. It's your first experience in the team car this week. You've had a long career as a rider, and this is your first time behind the wheel. So how's it been going so far?
It's been good. It's been a kind of a quick learning experience. As I said, I did this race 6 years in a row. I did it last year as a rider. And you obviously know everything down to the ground as a rider, and you kind of think you know the runnings of the sport, but actually, you know, when I got up here, I had no idea, you know, what I needed to do in terms of just getting a radio into the car for communication with the commissaires, etc. So it's been a quick learning experience from that point of view. And also in the convoy, you know, just learning what the commissaires do and don't want you to do all the time, when you're allowed to move up, when you're allowed to service your riders. And yeah, it's just something that you just never really see as a rider, unless you pack a lot of races and get into a team car, I guess, then you don't see that side of the sport.
What sort of position have you been in the convoy? Because the team cars go in order. There's at least 15, 16 team cars, plus there'll be another set of team cars behind that as well. So how close to the back of the race have you managed to get so far?
Well, I'm in the second team car, and we've had a guy in the break for both of the road stages. In fact, we had two guys in the first one. So then, of course, you're, you know, much closer to actually seeing something, because I think it was just us and Rafa and one or two others that were up there behind the break. Because some of the guys here have only got one team car, so they, and Post asked me if I'd service their guy in the break as well in case he had a puncture or wanted a bot or anything like that. So I've seen a fair bit, and then of course they pull you out when it's you know, less than a minute's gap, and then when you're at the back again, you can't really see much at all as a second team car, because of course you've got the entire convoy and then the second lot of cars. I think we were car number 7 for the second stage, but only because the organisers made a mistake the previous day with the timings of the finish. So we had a guy that was provisionally on 8th overall, and in fact they just called over the radio at the start of the stage to say we've made some changes, but we were car 7 already by that point, so we kept it.
You service the Ann Post rider in the break, because obviously you rode for that team, so just helping them out, that was having ridden for them, do them a favour, because obviously otherwise their rider would be left without any service up there.
Yeah, I think it happens quite a lot, you know, especially in a race where there's only one team car, and you know, you've got somebody in the break and then people in the bunch to service as well. It makes it difficult, and you know, despite all the rivalries on the road, generally people get on quite well within amongst different teams, and you know, they're happy to help each other out. Of course, there's neutral service as well, but yeah, I don't know, Kurt Bogart's very always a good friend of mine, as you said, from the time that I rode in his team, and so he's just leaving me a rain bag for his guy, and yeah, bottles and gels and that sort of thing.
So you're in car number 2. Am I right in thinking that that's probably the better one to be in? Because if there is a break, it's car number 2 that generally goes up to follow the break, and car number 1 stays behind the bunch. Or how do you work it with your team?
I think we might swap it over at some point during the race, and I'll be in car 1. But yeah, it's been good in car 2, just, you know, heading up towards the break, and because of course without race radios, it's nice just to be able to sort of wind the window down and go across, you know, up to the break and just have a word. And because we haven't got anybody here for the GC, but we've got a reasonable chance of picking up one of the jerseys, whether that's the KOM or the intermediate sprints jersey. And you know, that would be amazing for the team if we could be on the podium, even if we only had the jersey for a couple of days. It's kind of all about exposure for IG Secret Sport at this race, and the only way we're going to get that is by showing ourselves in the early break. So I think, you know, for somebody like Sky being in the second team car, you're never going to see anything, because they're very unlikely to be in an early breakaway. So it's only the day where perhaps it slips, where they might see a little bit more action, and their job is really in the second team car. You know, if a rider gets dropped, or somebody like Bernard Eisel has done his work for the day and drops back, then they just stick behind, so they see very little, I imagine.
What's the biggest challenge? Because it can get pretty hectic following the race. You're driving pretty fast, or it feels very fast, even though it's probably not fast by sort of driving on A-road standards, but you've got so much to keep an eye out for. You must need eyes in the back of your head. Have you had any close moments yet?
I haven't had any close moments. I mean, it's, of course, when the riders, you know, stop at the side of the road for a pee or whatever it might be, and coming back through the convoy when you have to be really, really careful, and, you know, it's very easy to just concentrate on your own drive and forget that, you know, what's coming up behind you. And again, as a rider, you don't really think about it. You just sort of assume that all of the guys driving the car just know exactly what they're doing. But, I think that's one of the benefits of having a lot of ex-riders driving the cars. I mean, I remember Sky sort of saying it's not really sometimes necessarily a reason to have an ex-rider as a direct sportif, but I think in the convoy, knowing the way it works and knowing, you know, what riders want when they're being paced back up. I mean, that's another disconcerting thing is, you know, as a rider, you sort of spend quite a lot of your life, you know, a few inches away from a bumper getting back on after a puncture or a mechanical or whatever it might be. But when you've got a rider just, you know, a few inches off your back and you can see something dangerous coming up, it's very disconcerting, and, you know, you don't want to make any kind of rash or sudden movements that might cause them any problem. And if there's a hole coming up, you just need to sort of try and see it well in advance and gradually drift away, so there's no chance of them hitting that. So there's a fair bit to think about. There's not too many parts of the day where you're completely bored, I have to say.
And finally, the weather so far has been cold and wet. You made a bit of a joke on Twitter about the inconvenience of having to open your car window to give somebody a bottle because you were getting your arm wet. No pangs of regret that you're not out there racing this week?
Well, I haven't got the window down far enough to give out a bottle. I just had to stick to gels. No, I have to say, I have been fairly smug the first couple of days climbing into the car and putting the temperature up to 21 or 22. It's been a really tough couple of days for everybody because they've been quite long stages as well. And if you compare the stage lengths to sort of European races, it looks quite similar, but it's something about the roads in the UK. They just seem harder. So there's quite often, you know, there's quite often stages abroad where you'll cruise along for 40 km without even thinking about it, without making hardly any effort on the bike, and it just, you know, an hour goes past. Whereas back here, it's I don't know what it is. There's just never seems to be a point where it's just really, really easy like that for an extended period of time. And especially when you get down to Devon, I mean, it amazes me every year when I go back to that county and do part of the Tour of Britain. There just doesn't seem to be a metre of flat. It's incredible, you know, with the wet weather as well. It makes it really hard to recover. So I'm pretty sure there's a few fairly tired guys out there already, even on day four.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
Roger Hammond, this must be one of these days when you're glad that you're not riding anymore, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those. Well, actually, this week has been this week of being happy with my decision in 2011. I mean, it's those days where you really, you just have to really focus on the end game and why you're here. And I mean, for us, actually, you know, this is the pinnacle of our season, so actually it's an advantage for us. It's, you know, it's harder for the guys that, you know, are here just to get from A to B with no ambition. Guys with ambition, you know, it does negatively affect you a bit, but not as much as those guys that don't want to be here anyway.
It's a huge shame for the event, isn't it, that this, because Britain isn't like this all the time.
That's what I try to keep telling the foreign riders here, but they don't believe me. No, it is. I mean, it's a real shame. You know, the event's been growing and growing and growing, and things like this, you know, don't show it off in its best light, especially for the guys that are coming here to prepare for World Championships. You know, you don't want to get sick, and then you're in weather like this. It is unfortunate, but, you know, you can't control the weather. I've been into some shocking stage races in Europe, so, you know, that's outdoor sport, isn't it?
And what have you made of the race so far? We're now sort of day five today.
Yeah,
what have you made of it so far?
Yeah, it's only one of those one of those races that's a bit, you know, a bit odd actually. It's almost like it's struggled to get going. You know, the time trial, I think the time trial so early on, but not the first or second day, kind of neutralised those first 2 days. And then the day post time trial, everyone sort of had a kind of a breather. And then I think today for the next 3 days is really where we're going to see some action, and the race decided. I hope so. So you know, I think the circuit's hard enough now that that we should see
quite
it today.
Selective.
I mean, and with this weather, it's just going to make what was already a selective day even more selective.
Yeah, a team like Sky have been controlling it, really, you know, anticipating the time trial, and obviously got the result they wanted. And can you see them just controlling the rest of the race? Are they going to be able to do that, do you think?
Well, I mean, that's obviously the plan they're doing. They've gone out there and they've controlled it right from the beginning without the jersey anyway, so you know, they've sent out their signals of what they're going to do. I think it's the way, that's the only plan they have. So with the team they have here now, they've got both Ian and Brad there riding really well. I think they'll try and control it. Now, what's the spanner in the works? That we're only six-man teams here, and if you've got first and second on GC, Bernie Eisel struggled with illness in the beginning of the race, so you know, you start getting very thin on numbers. And the problem is it's not a personal thing, but you know, they are the leaders of the race, so naturally the rest of the race wants to get rid of them. It's not nothing personal against Sky, it's just how it is. When you're the leader, you're the ones to be beaten, so they will have 100 riders racing against them. So.
And what do you want out of the race? I mean, a team like yours, what are your ambitions here?
We came here with an ambition of riding Ian Bibby into a very high GC. You know, he had extremely good form and was going very well before the race. We had to be realistic that we needed luck. You know, as the more powerful the teams go, you know, you can get over bad luck. And then there's a medium teams where, you know, as long as they don't have bad luck, they'll be all right. And then we're us, where we needed luck. And unfortunately, we've not only had no luck, we've had bad luck. So, you know, we've had two crashes in the first 2 days, and now struggling with a slight knee injury from the second crash. You know, it's really just knocked him out. So we've got to reevaluate, almost beginning our tour again today now, and we'll go from there. I mean, for us, it's about trying to pick up stage wins now, and that means exploiting the areas that we think we can do it. Can we win a bunch sprint with Cav here? I don't think so. Can we win a mountain top finish with Quintana here? I'm not really sure to wait for that. So, you know, we're looking at other opportunities and trying to work out what fits our team characteristics best.
And how about you? How are you enjoying being a DS? Is this something you see yourself doing in the long term as well? I mean, you've done it a couple of years now, or this is your second year, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, well, last year was just sort of building the team, really. That was, so it wasn't really DSing. This is more, you know, getting involved, and really this is my first real year of DSing. So it's been a real voyage of discovery. I mean, I never ever said that just being a good bike rider is about, you know, being that you'd be a good DS. I knew I was going to start at zero. Hopefully I'm learning fast, but it's a lot different to how I was, you know, how at the job as a bike rider. The only similarities I've found so far is they're both bottomless pits. You know, you can, as a bike rider, you could throw in as many hours as there was in a week, and that would never be enough. And the same with the sports director. I just feel that, you know, I could work at this job 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year long, and there'd still be jobs to do. So for that, I like those kind of challenges. I like to bite off big parts of the apple and get stuck in. So that part of them I'm enjoying. But it is challenging, very, very challenging.
Yeah, I mean, you had a long career and rode for lots of teams, some big teams. Are there any DSs you worked with who were particularly, not necessarily you're trying to copy them, but who inspired you or who were particularly effective, do you think?
Oh, I mean, yeah, they're pretty obvious, really, because their teams are successful. You know, you see where they go from, if they change teams, that team is immediately successful, and the obvious one. And, you know, the guy that I really see as my mentor is Brian Home. I think he strikes the balance of being a manager and being a support and being a friend. He really, and cool and calm and collected. You know, that's I didn't see that as the job. Is not, you're the guy that's not breathing at 190 heart rate and seeing red and so knackered you that can't even remember your own name. So I'm the person that has to make calm, collected decisions, and I think he personifies that, really. You know,
he personifies calm, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's, I think he nominated you for one of his Brit Awards on Twitter the other day.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Clever, because he knows I'm learning from him. So
do you still speak to him quite a lot then?
Loads, yeah. I mean, I do keep in contact him. He's offered me a lot of advice this year. Any real issues, he's always on the end of the phone for me. He is my mentor, so he was my mentor as a bike rider, and now he's my mentor as a manager, actually. So
if you're going to emulate him, probably going to have to grow up a long beard.
Yeah, yeah. And more hair on the top of my head, which is going to be and be quite cool and good looking. So I've got plastic surgery and all sorts to do.
Cycling podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
So we heard there from Dan Lloyd and Roger Hammond. Lionel, you were going to say something about that pair.
Well, yeah, I think Jonathan Vorters tweeted something. Jonathan Vorters, the head honcho at the Garmin Sharp team, who of course was Dan Lloyd rode for Garmin at the end of his career. He tweeted something about Dan Lloyd, who was obviously making his directorial debut here at the Tour of Britain, and said that Lloyd has got all of the kind of these sort of intelligence and sharpness and qualities that you would look for in an excellent sports director. I think Roger Hammond is another one who, you know, he can clearly read a bike race. He's got loads of experience of certain types of racing.
I think
the pair of them, you know, Charlie Wagelius has already proved at Garmin Sharp that, you know, if you can apply that kind of bike racing logic and intelligence with a kind of an emotional intelligence, if you like, you can become an incredibly key and very almost sort of fast-tracked himself into a really senior role there. I mean, he's only been retired, you know, a couple of years, and yet he is, you know, he's pulling big results out of the bag. And you could see if things developed Daniel, that they could become sort of quite good.
Those guys all have something in common, don't they? They are, and none of them were stars as bike riders, which again, you know, in football we see that as well, don't we? That the best managers sometimes weren't the star players, and they seem to understand the job and maybe have more empathy with the riders than some of the stars do. And Dan Lloyd is, we know him well, he's a very bright, intelligent guy who, I remember when he was retiring, there was talk of him becoming a DS at Garmin Sharp, and I'm not sure what went wrong there. There was also talk at the end of last year that both Roger Hammond and Dan Lloyd would go to Sky as sports directors, at a time when Sky were obviously losing people and looking for new people, and I understood that the offers were made to both, and that for whatever reason neither is there.
Well, it's a huge commitment, isn't it? You're making the same commitment that you have to make as a rider, an awful lot of time away from from home, from family. I would imagine the sort of the mindset required to go from racing month in, month out, traveling, all of that, and then going straight into a director sportif role. I would have thought, maybe the would benefit from a little bit of time away doing other things and
gaining a bit of experience at a lower level.
Absolutely. I mean, the director sportif role is much misunderstood, I think, particularly these days as it has evolved and it's become, you're fulfilling so many different roles within the team. You're kind of like a logistics overseer, and you're a man motivator, and you're a shoulder to cry on, and you're the man that's got to crack the whip, and you've got to drive the car, and you've got to basically make sure that
at Sky, actually, because they've got some more roles are more divided up there, I think.
Possibly,
yeah, and the DS has a slightly lesser role.
But perhaps. Still, Cerveis Carnarvon's driving the car this week, isn't he? And on the tour they do kind of rotate around a bit, and they have redefined the role a little bit at Sky, perhaps. And I think Garmin Sharp have they've done it in a slightly different way to Sky, but still, it's not the traditional old, you hang up your racing shoes in October, and then in February you get behind the wheel of the car, and you're expected to be a sort of, a stellar sports director. I think there's an old school mentality that is slowly dying out.
Yeah.
And looking at the way that, and I think Brian Holm as well was, and Rolf Aldag,
who Roger Hammond mentioned in the interview, as his main inspiration and mentor.
Yeah. When Brian Holm and Rolf Aldag were both together at HTC Columbia, now both together at Quickstep, they've divided up the role of sports director quite intelligently. Brian is much more sort of hands-on on the ground, drives the car at the races, and Rolf is a bit more kind of detached, but he's kind of overseeing strategy, overseeing a lot of other aspects of the Quickstep, Amiga Pharma Quickstep operation. And I think, you know, it's really interesting just sort of talking to those guys and seeing how they feel about the role. And so hearing Daniel and Roger there talking about their own experiences, you know, early days for both of them in events of this.
Now, Lionel, I've found, as we mentioned earlier, the place that we stayed last night, I've found it. That's it. That was it there, if you want to tell our listeners where we stayed last night.
I have no idea how you pronounce that. It's Tiedorf. I don't know.
Is Tiedorf.
I have no idea. T-Y.
D-E-R-W. Country House B&B. The old road in, Lionel.
Well, I mean, I would want to say Dinas Mordri. But, I mean, that sounds...
There's no R there. Modwy.
M-A-W-D-W-Y.
Very nice.
Welsh is like a foreign language to me, I'm afraid.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.
So, Richard, earlier in the Tour of Britain, you managed to get out of the rain for half an hour or so by getting on board the new Garmin Sharp team bus and talking to their driver, Andrea.
Andrea Bisogno, who's known as Biso.
Right.
So, yeah, I did.
The team buses are something that provoke a lot of interest from the fans because it's somewhere that they...
It's where the riders are.
It's where the riders are, and it's somewhere that they generally don't get to see. And, you know, I think Sky kind of upped the ante with their super bus. With the Death Star, yeah. But Garmin Sharp.
Well, they've come to the Tour of Britain with a new bus, which piqued my interest. So I went and knocked on the door, and there was Andrea Bisogno inside making some pasta, as you know, waiting for the riders to come in. So I went on board, and he gave me a little tour of the bus and explained what is different. And there is something quite different about this bus, as you will hear in this interview. Okay, I'm on the Garmin Sharp team bus with Andrea Bisogno, known as Biso, the driver of the bus. This is a new bus, isn't it? Can you tell me? It smells very new. You can smell the leather. Tell me what's special about this new bus.
The most important part that we have in a bus is a solar panel, because with this we can run almost everything in a bus without use the generator. So for an environment, it's the best way for...
I mean, when you're at a race like this, the buses are lined up like this, and they sit for hours with their engines on the whole time. So can you switch the engine off just now?
Yeah. We can switch the engine off, and actually, also during the night, we don't need power because we have a battery. So the fridge and freezer can run with battery, so... We are 100% independent. So
you're doing your bit for the environment. And so the solar panel, does it go across the whole? How big is it?
Yeah, we have from the bottom of the bus since half, because in the front there is the AC compartment from the bus, so we cannot fill all the roof with the solar panel, but it's more than enough.
It's a big bus as well. Is this bigger than the previous team bus?
Yeah. This is 2 meter longer. It's 40 meter. The previous bus was 12 meters, so it's quite big. Yeah.
And how are you finding it on these narrow British roads?
It's probably not the best race for start with a new bus, because also I need to learn, because, you know, it's 2 meter longer. It's not easy sometimes, but it's okay.
You're enjoying it so far. How long have you been with the team?
It's my fifth year, and already 13 years. In the cycling world. So,
and any other special features on the bus? I mean, we're looking down, it's the usual sort of 9 leather reclinable seats for the riders, nice wooden paneling on the floor, and it looks like bunk beds in the back here.
Yeah, we have these beds in the back for let the rider lay down after the race when we are long transfer. It's the best way for start to recovery. And then we have a full TV in the front, in the back, in the middle. We have a projector there, and all the stuff that we have from the sponsor.
And here you're boiling up a big pan of pasta. What is this for the riders after the stage?
Yeah. We need to prepare some food after the race. So we have two kind of recovery drink, and then we make rice and pasta.
And being Italian, that'll be nice and al dente.
yeah, for sure, it will be al dente.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Richard, it's interesting there that the bus driver, Andrea, is actually making the pasta for the riders so that when they get back to the bus after the stage, they've got something to eat to refuel. I mean, that in itself is quite interesting, quite unusual, that the bus driver also has to have the skills to make the perfect al dente pasta.
Well, you know, he's Italian, so that'll come naturally to him, obviously. He did explain that he, you know, the role is extremely varied, and, you know, it's interesting how he's not just a bus driver, he's a bus driver to a professional cycling team, and has a lot of the knowledge, I suppose, that you gain from being around the sport, and knows what the riders need, what they want. The point he made as well about the solar panels, you know, this bus has the solar panels, is an interesting and dare I say an important point, I think, because people, the impression that people might have of bike racing is that it's a very green, environmentally friendly sport, and you walk past the line of buses and all their engines are on for hours and hours and hours, and spewing out all kinds. You had a statistic. I mean, yeah, you knew how much the it costs to actually fill one of these buses.
Well, not even fill. When I was on the Dauphiné in France with the Sky team a couple of years ago, on the first day, which was a prologue time trial, and the bus was driving up to the start town ahead of all the riders who were going to follow later in the Jaguar team cars, and we stopped at the petrol station on the auto route, and the bus driver, a very nice man called Chris Slark, put €650 worth of fuel in it. And I said, blimey, that takes a lot to fill the tank.
More than our Astra.
Yeah. I said, you know, that costs a lot to fill the tank. And he said, oh, no, that would just be just over halfway.
Wow.
And he says, you know, carrying the fuel is obviously burning the fuel, you know, so if you fill the tank, you're wasting money because you're burning fuel, carrying all that extra fuel around. So he's kind of got his own fueling strategy. And yeah, like you say, on a time trial day where the bus will be parked, the riders will all be in it, they'll come out and warm up for their own individual time trial start times, the generator will be running for maybe 7-8 hours, and that's burning a heck of a lot of fuel. And you know, they've got on board, they've got cookers, fridges, shower, you know, toilet, all of the things they want, and they're all plugging in their iPads and headphones and the Wi-Fi and the big screen showing the satellite TV. It's burning an awful lot of fuel, and that's just the bus. Then you've got 3 or 4 team cars. You know, the sport has really made an effort in the last 2 or 3 years to kind of clean up a little bit with not having too many plastic water bottles thrown in the hedgerow, energy gel wrappers. It's been good to see several of the riders on the TV coverage eating their energy gel and then putting the wrapper back in their pockets rather than just turfing it to the roadside. And I think, you know, the Tour de France has had these litter zones, hasn't it, after the feed zone, where the riders can throw their rubbish away and it will all get gathered up as long as it's in this particular zone. And there's been more fines handed out for littering and stuff. So I think the environmental aspect of big bike races, you know, we're travelling hundreds of miles, there's so many cars involved, you know, you look at the peloton of riders and then the team cars alone, 40 vehicles, all the motorbikes. So it's interesting that Garmin Sharp are doing something
More solar panels, please. I mean, this is obviously providing the energy to run the bus and while they're waiting for the riders, and to keep the fridges and everything operating at night. So
I can't help but feel, given the weather this week, it hasn't been terribly effective.
If it's working here, then it's going to work anywhere, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Anyway, we'll wrap up there. We'll come back on Sunday and do another podcast from London, wrapping up the Tour of Britain. We'll have more audio then as well. Please join us then, and we'll see if Bradley Wiggins has become the second British rider to win the revived Tour of Britain after Jonathan Tiernan Locke last year.